CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
The perfect business gift is simple to give and a joy to get. That's exactly what Omaha Steaks business gifts deliver. Omaha Steaks offers a huge variety, from premium steaks to skillet meals. They also offer flexible gift plans for big and small businesses. Order the perfect business gift to try the Omaha Steaks gift experience for yourself, or send it as a gift. The perfect business gift includes 4 5-ounce bacon-wrapped tri-tip steaks, 4 4-ounce Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 3-ounce gourmet franks, 2 4-ounce boneless pork chops, 4 3-ounce kielbasa sausages. Plus, you'll get free shipping and 4 free caramel apple tartlets. This exclusive package is only $59.99. So go to omahasteaks.com, type Nation in the search bar, and choose the perfect business gift. Again, visit omahasteaks.com and enter code Nation in the search bar to send or experience this exclusive gift package for only $59.99.
Today on Face the Nation, breaking news overnight as North Korea says they've tested a hydrogen bomb, and Texas struggles to recover following Hurricane Harvey. Just hours after his return from Texas and Louisiana, where he toured the devastation caused by Harvey, President Trump faces yet another escalation in the North Korea crisis, as the country says they've conducted their most powerful nuclear test yet. It was the president and the first lady's second trip to the state since Harvey struck 9 days ago. In Houston, they spent time with evacuees in the convention center and handed out relief supplies. President Trump pledged quick financial aid from the federal government.
$7.9 billion. We signed it, and now it's going through a very quick, hopefully quick process.
And he had plenty of praise for recovery officials.
And Brock, come here a minute, Brock. What a job you've done, huh? What a job. And the water's disappearing, and we have a long way to go, but the water's disappearing.
The floodwaters are disappearing, but the cleanup and recovery facing millions of Texans is just beginning. We'll get updates from our team in Texas, as well as the mayor of Houston, Sylvester Turner, and the head of FEMA, Brock Long. Plus, we'll look at the potential health risks as a result of Harvey, and we'll hear from Texan himself, Bob Schieffer, about the spirit of the Lone Star State and its ability to get through tough times.
As tough as this was, it's been a wonderful thing. I think even for the country to watch and for the world to watch. It's been beautiful.
But as Congress heads back to Washington and faces battles over funding the government, will that spirit of unity prompted by Harvey last? We'll talk about that and the president's plan to potentially overturn an Obama administration directive that protects children of undocumented immigrants from deportation. It's all coming up on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. John Dickerson is off today. I'm Margaret Brennan. There is breaking news this morning as North Korea says they've successfully tested a hydrogen bomb capable of being mounted on a missile that could reach the U.S. mainland. If so, it's a dramatic escalation in North Korean President Kim Jong-un's efforts to build his country's nuclear capability. President Trump has tweeted the first official U.S. response, saying their words and actions continue to be very hostile and dangerous to the United States. North Korea is a rogue nation which has become a great threat and embarrassment to China, which is trying to help, but with little success. We begin our coverage with CBS News correspondent Ben Tracy reporting from Tokyo.
North Korea triumphantly confirmed its test of a hydrogen bomb on state television. A strong 6.3 magnitude earthquake was detected at 12:30 Sunday afternoon in northeast North Korea, near that country's main nuclear test site. The underground test appears to be about 10 times more powerful than the last one North Korea carried out 1 year ago. It came just hours after the country released these pictures of its leader, Kim Jong-un, inspecting what North Korea claims is a miniaturized hydrogen bomb capable of fitting on an intercontinental ballistic missile. Last week, North Korea launched yet another ballistic missile, sending it over northern Japan in a provocative warning shot to the United States and its allies. The U.S. and South Korea responded by conducting high-profile bombing drills on the Korean Peninsula. In July, North Korea conducted 2 successful tests of intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of hitting the United States, and says its latest nuclear test was designed to perfect a nuclear warhead for those missiles. Ever since its elaborate military parade this past April, North Korea has warned that it was ready to conduct this nuclear test, but said it would happen at a time of Kim Jong-un's choosing. Kim Jong-un has significantly accelerated the pace of North Korea's weapons development despite international sanctions designed to cripple his regime. Just this year, he has launched 18 missiles, and this is now the fourth nuclear test carried out since he took over North Korea in 2011.
We want to bring in CBS News senior national security contributor and former deputy director of the CIA, Michael Morrell, for some analysis. Mike, what did we learn today with this test?
Kim Jong-un has been undergoing a pattern of demonstrating enhanced capabilities. So in the last 6 months, we've had submarine-launched ballistic missiles. We've had simultaneous launches of multiple missiles. We've had missiles capable of reaching the continental United States. And now we have the most significant nuclear test to date. So he wants to demonstrate his ability to put a U.S. city at risk of nuclear attack. That is where he's driving.
And can he hold a U.S. city hostage with that threat?
So we don't know for sure exactly where he's at. There's four pieces to this. The first piece is having nuclear weapons that actually work. We know that's the case. This is the sixth test. The second is having a missile capable of flying that far. He's now demonstrated that. The third is having a nuclear weapon small enough to put on one of those missiles. We don't know for sure whether he can do that or not. The intelligence community, an elite intelligence community assessment from late July, the Defense Intelligence Agency says he has that capability. That leaves us with the fourth, which is the whole thing working under the pressures of reentry. Right, having the separation of the warhead from the missile work and having all of the electronics work under that great pressure and speed and heat of reentry, right? We don't know if he can do that or not. So not sure exactly where he is, but every time he does one of these, he demonstrates to us greater and greater capability.
What do we know about Kim Jong-un himself? I mean, what you just laid out, it sounds like he's boxing in President Trump to negotiate on his own terms.
So this capability that he is after, right, to put U.S. cities at risk. Three reasons for him. One is he wants to enhance his own political prestige at home. He's put a lot of political capital in being able to do this at home. That's one reason.
Is he in peril?
I think he's not, but I think he's somewhat paranoid. You know, he has killed many members of the elite, who that suggests to me that perhaps he thinks he's in some peril, but he wants to strengthen himself at home. The second reason is he wants to be able to deter us. He believes that we want to overthrow him. He believes that we want to reunite the Korean Peninsula on the South's terms. Right? We don't. We don't want to do that, but he believes it. So he sees these weapons as the ultimate deterrent. And then I think the third reason he wants them is he wants to be able to extort us. So once he can demonstrate this capability, then he'll say, come and sit at the table. I'm a nuclear power. Let's have a different kind of conversation. And let's start the conversation by saying, you, the United States, needs to leave the Korean Peninsula. So I think he wants to do all three of those things. I think, Margaret, that people are wrong when they say he's crazy. He's not crazy. He's very rational in his own world. He is smart. He is decisive. He is persistent. But he's also an attention seeker. He's also paranoid in the way I talked about. And he's also extraordinarily violent. So this is a different kind of guy.
So President Trump convenes his national security team today. What are his options?
So he has the first option, which any president has, which is diplomacy, right? Try to convince this person to step back from the brink. That's failed for the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. And there is absolutely no reason to believe it's going to be successful now. But I think we need to try and we need to push that. But if that fails, which I think it will, we're left with two options. A military option, mm-hmm. which would be probably not be successful in fully degrading his capabilities and could create probably most likely a second Korean War,
yeah.
thousands of deaths, or the other option is acceptance of this capability, containment, deterrence, just the way we contained and deterred the Soviet Union.
Tough options, either way.
Very tough options. Bad options.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We turn now to the other big story we're following this morning, Harvey's aftermath. The floodwaters are receding, but the death toll and financial toll continue to climb. At least 45 people have died as a result of Harvey, and the governor of Texas says damages will be much more than Hurricane Katrina, with some estimates reaching more than $160 billion. More than 1 million people have been displaced. Some 200,000 homes were damaged or destroyed in Texas and Louisiana. And gas prices have now jumped 26 cents a gallon nationally since just last week. We begin our coverage of Harvey this morning with CBS News correspondent Anna Werner reporting from Beaumont, Texas.
Well, while Houston and some parts of Texas may be in recovery mode, here in the Beaumont area, there are still entire subdivisions underwater. And what's worse, residents in Beaumont still have no drinking water. But last night, city officials announced they believe they've come up with what should be a temporary fix.
We are not at the finish line, but we've undoubtedly regained a second wind.
Beaumont Mayor Becky Ames told reporters a temporary solution should restore the water service lost. The city's 120,000 residents have no drinking water and are waiting in long lines for bottled water. But engineers have been working around the clock and now say they've come up with a stopgap fix, setting up temporary pumps to provide a water supply.
Sounds like you feel like you pulled off a save here.
It really did feel like a win, and it still does, but we have a long way to go.
As the city and private companies work to bring up the water pressure, first responders in Crosby, Texas, are watching the flooded chemical plant that caught fire Friday after two explosions, releasing black smoke. The plant owner warned more explosions could come, and officials are monitoring air quality after the release of potentially hazardous chemicals.
Our national anthem.
But some sense of normalcy returned Saturday as the Houston Astros played their first home game since Harvey struck. Players and fans observed a moment of silence, and Houston's mayor took a break from hurricane recovery to throw out the first pitch.
On the corner.
While Texans are anxious to return to their daily lives, it will be days, probably weeks, before many can return home here.
CBS News correspondent David Begno has been covering Harvey since it made landfall 9 days ago. He's in South Houston this morning. David, how's the recovery going where you are?
Slowly and delicately. Margaret, people have letters from World War II that are drying in the front yard, pictures of a baby's baptism. The Abadou family lives here. They had a foot of water inside their house. Nearly everything was ruined. And so to protect what they have left from looters, which is a real problem around here, they've been sleeping in that tent for the last 4 nights with a box fan to keep them cool. It is as hot and humid here in Houston as you can imagine. But in the air, there's also a moldy, musty smell. In fact, for folks who have respiratory issues, officials are saying the air quality is very unhealthy. As you look outside the Abadou home, their belongings stretch around the sidewalk. And as you look down the street, what appears to be piles of trash or personal treasures. And it goes on as far as you can see. Especially as you get into the outer suburbs, it is unimaginable how many homes have been affected by this disaster. You know what have been the gems throughout all of this? The civilian Samaritans.
Tell us where to get.
The people who are recovery workers today were rescuers on Monday. Folks who we rode with, who took people out of their home in chest-deep water and brought them to safety, have returned to those homes to help people rebuild, ripping out sheetrock. We're talking about people who don't even know the victims of this national disaster, but showed up at their doorstep and said, "What can I do for you?"
David Begna, thank you. We go now to the mayor of Houston, Sylvester Turner, who joins us from the city's convention center. Good morning to you, Mayor. I want to know, what does Houston need right now? And what did you ask President Trump for when you met with him yesterday?
Well, two things in terms of immediate needs, you know, housing assistance. We need rapid repair housing because many, many people have elected to stay in their homes. They're now dry. But they need to be repaired. In some cases, they may need to be rebuilt. And this is especially important for our seniors, low-income communities, but really people all over the city. So housing, rapid repair housing. And I asked him to expand the rapid repair housing program from 15,000 up to 35,000. The second thing, debris removal. Most of the city is now dry, and people are already putting out their heavy debris. Now, the city of Houston started on Thursday picking up this heavy debris, but we have to get it done like now. It can't be sitting around 30, 45, you know, 2 months from now. And so advanced funding for debris removal, he understood it. It was a very productive meeting. But those are the two things that I'm highlighting up at the very front. Housing, 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 recovery centers so that people can register, go through the FEMA process. And then the third thing, I don't want to leave this out. We have had first responders that have been out here assisting everybody else. But many of my first responders, over 300, have had serious flooding problems themselves. And so I asked for an expedited FEMA registration processing system specifically for first responders, and he really gave a thumbs up on that.
Sir, Houston is the center of the petrochemical industry in this country. You've got so much stagnant water there. What kind of contamination have you seen, and what kind of help is the EPA giving you right now?
Well, that's still being assessed. Most of those Superfund sites are immediately outside of the city of Houston. Certainly, we would hope that the EPA would be on the ground now to take a look at those Superfund sites to make sure that contamination is contained and limited. But I can't specifically speak to that. Many of those areas are outside of the city of Houston.
Can you say that Houston is safe now, or that the drinking water is safe, given that potential contamination?
The drinking water was never a question. Our plants continued to function. So the water, no one had to boil any water in the city of Houston. The water system is safe. The electric grid is pretty much sound. There are only about 12,000 people in the city of Houston without power. The airport system is up and running. The transit system is up and running. We've started picking up heavy debris. Let me be very, very clear. The city of Houston is open for business. Anyone who was planning on a conference or a convention or a sporting event or a concert coming to this city, you can still come. We want you to still come. We can do multiple things at the same time. Now, we're checking on our seniors, low-income communities, houses across the city of Houston to make sure that we are repairing those homes, but we can do that at the same time. There are only two areas that are underwater in the city of Houston. That's in the northeast in Kingwood. That's getting better. And then in West Houston, those homes didn't flood because of the rainfall. They are flooding because of the release of water from the reservoir. And right now, we're only talking about 26 homes in West Houston. And what I've said to them, if you have water in your home, we're requiring you to evacuate. But if you don't have any water in your home, you are fine. So I want to be very clear. Yes, it was a very, very serious storm, historic, unprecedented. But the city of Houston is open for business. And so if you have a conference, a convention, a concert, any of those things that you were planning to come to this city, we are still ready to welcome you. On Tuesday, we are getting back on our feet, and I'm expecting employers to open, employees to go to work, and all city employees, you are due back at work on Tuesday.
An important message, given that Houston is America's fifth largest economy. I know you want to drive that home, but can you give me a sense? Yesterday, you were trying to send that message clearly with this baseball game you had in your city. You threw out the first opening pitch. What did that feel like? I mean, does it feel like recovery is where you are now?
It felt good. People were cheering. There were smiles. And by the way, I want to appreciate the New York Mets because they came down and they were at one of the first responder sites at the police officers serving them lunch. I appreciate the Houston Mets. You know, Houston Astros won both of those games. Let me just say that. We won both. And so people are feeling good. Even at this shelter where we are right now, at its peak, there were 10,000 people in this shelter. The number is down to significantly less than 2,000 in just a matter of five days. The city of Houston, just like the surrounding region, was seriously hurt. And it's going to be a very expensive proposition. And we're going to take it day by day, week by week.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this is a can-do city. This is a can-do city. We're not going to, you know, engage in a pity party. We're going to take care of each other. Neighbors are taking care of each other. Good Samaritans. Businesses are responding. Community, neighborhood people are responding. But we are getting back on our feet, and we are open for business. And we do want people to continue to come to the city. The port, let me just say, the Port of Houston. The Port of Houston is now open.
Mm-hmm. Mayor, so many Americans thinking of your city this weekend. I want to thank you for joining us today. And we'll be back in 1 minute.
Continue to pray for us.
We will.
Thank you.
The head of FEMA, Brock Long, will join us.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your jobs to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then, their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate through the site within one day. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/FTN. That's ZipRecruiter.com/FTN. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/FTN. That's ZipRecruiter.com/FTN. ZipRecruiter.com/FTN.
We're back with the head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. Brock Long joins us from their headquarters in Washington. It's been a very busy time for you, sir. I appreciate you making the time. Can you tell us, the White House has already asked for about $7 billion. Expect billions more to be needed in Houston quite soon. How much money does FEMA need to help this recovery?
That's hard to estimate right now. Obviously, not only is the president fully engaged, you know, his staff, Tom Bossert, Secretary Duke, all of us are working together to correctly inform the Congress on how to give us the enduring authority to go forward to make sure that we meet the demands for not only Harvey, but potentially threatening Irma out there as well. So I feel like what we have going on right now is an excellent communication, you know, with the Congress, and the Congress knows what needs to be done to make sure that we can meet the demands of what's going on.
You mentioned Irma. It appears to be strengthening. What are you expecting from that hurricane?
Well, what bothers me about Irma what we need the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and folks down in southeastern United States as well as the Mid-Atlantic is that anytime a hurricane has a well-defined center of circulation, the confidence in that forecast track is pretty high when it comes from the National Hurricane Center. The models are in pretty good agreement. Right now, we are ramping up. We've already forward deployed commodities into our island territories, where we've already forward deployed incident management teams to Puerto Rico as well as the Virgin Islands. So we're shifting focus to Irma as well as maintaining the effort to make sure that we have recovery command established in Texas and Louisiana.
Now, when it comes to Harvey, 33 trillion gallons of water dumped on U.S. soils has been called a one-in-1,000-year event. Do we need to be prepared for more extreme weather like this? And is the onus on the states rather than the federal government?
So I think that's an excellent question. And I need state representatives and state legislative officials and local elected officials to listen up. This is a call. It is a wake-up call for this country, for local and state elected officials, to give their governors and their emergency management directors, you know, the full budgets that they need to be fully staffed, to design rainy day funds, to have your own standalone individual assistance and public assistance programs. This is a wake-up call. People cannot depend solely on the Federal Emergency Management Agency to be responsible for a majority. Now, states do a lot of work. They do a lot of work. But I think that we all have to collectively sit down after this event and figure out how to collectively improve, as we've all
seen.
Are
you saying there, sir, that Texas should have done more to prepare?
No. Texas is a model. Governor Abbott, Chief Nim Kidd, those guys are a model. What we need are for elected officials at all levels of government to hit the reset button, sit down, evaluate where their programs are with their state emergency management directors as well as their local emergency management directors, and make sure that they have everything they need to increase their levels of self-sufficiency. This is a partnership, but this event is one that we're all going to have to sit down and hit the reset button on and figure out how we collectively improve.
Your agency oversees the National Flood Insurance Program, which is going to expire at the end of the month unless Congress acts. About 80% or more people in the area hit by Harvey don't have any flood insurance. What are you expecting? Are people there basically on their own?
It's tough. So individual assistance that's offered up by the Federal Emergency Management Agency is basically just a ray of hope. It's a bridge to kickstart recovery. Those who are uninsured are most likely eligible for FEMA's individual assistance program that can help them with a host of things, not only rapid repairs to their homes, maybe some funding for if they've lost their jobs and different things, or, you know, rental fees and that kind of thing that they can pay. The bottom line is that it's not going to be enough to make anybody whole. The other thing is that, you know, in this country, you know, federal disaster recovery support comes from a multitude of agencies. Also, the SBA will be offering up low-interest loans to those as well, because they have a disaster declaration. Yeah. HUD funding kicks in. So what we have to do is help citizens understand what they're entitled to kickstart their recovery.
Brock Long at FEMA, good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
If you're looking for ways to help the victims of Hurricane Harvey, please visit our website, cbsnews.com/floodhelp. We're joined now by Dr. Umair Shah, Executive Director of Harris County Public Health. He's coordinated the medical response at NRG Stadium this week, where more than 2,000 evacuees were sheltered and even had to evacuate his own house. Doctor, are you back home yet?
Yes, my family came home 2 days ago. It was a pretty harrowing experience for all of us. So, and it just underscores that this hasn't just impacted our community, it's impacted even our responders.
What is the feeling there on the ground? Do you have a sense that you have moved into the recovery phase?
Yeah, there are still some places where some streets that are having some flooding that has continued to have some impact on the recovery side. So that is, I don't want to say we've completely gotten out of that immediate phase, but yeah, we're moving towards that longer term look at what does recovery mean for our community.
And you've been telling people to avoid those floodwaters. They've got everything from snakes to alligators, and now this is concern about chemical contamination. For you, what is the greatest health risk?
Yeah. Apologies, there's a truck right behind me, so I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you. But just to let you know that, we've been talking to our community throughout this, before the storm, obviously during the storm, and even now post-storm, that flooded waters have a number of different hazards. And that includes, like you said, critters and snakes, those kinds of things, but also the real concern around down power lines. And really, our biggest concern is that these waters are not safe. They're not. There are harmful, whether substances or chemicals or bacteria, other kinds of infectious disease agents. And so, when folks are being exposed to these, we are really asking them, we're imploring them to take precautions so that they are cleaning, disinfecting, and doing those things. And if they have to even throw out items that they have that have been exposed to that. That's very difficult. As you know, for example, if children have their favorite toy and that toy has now been exposed to water and you can't clean it, and we're saying throw it out, that inherently becomes a really challenging message to a child.
What are some of those contaminants that you just gestured to? I mean, there was concern about this chemical plant and some explosions there and fumes in the air. But then there's also concern that there might be chemicals in those floodwaters. What are you seeing? What contaminants are there?
Right. So the kinds of things that you have to always think about is that the floodwater is, first of all, it's got, even if it looks clear, it likely has something in there. But the real concern is that household chemicals, just very, everyday chemicals that people have in their homes have now mixed into those waters. Then you also have the challenge where you might have a mechanic shop or another, business that may have been flooded out, and they may have other more industrial type of chemicals that can go in. And so I, rather than talking about the specifics, there are a lot of different chemicals that can go into the mix. And then obviously, as you've mentioned, when you have large-scale chemical activities, that really starts to become an increasing concern. So we have to really manage that, and that's why that message is just stay out of those waters or do what you need to do to clean and disinfect.
Do you feel you have all the resources you need? If you don't know the contaminants yet, do you feel like you're prepared to deal with the fallout?
You know, we've been through a lot of emergencies before, everything from Tropical Storm Allison, that we had a large-scale flood event, as you know, Hurricane Katrina, where we had 27,000, right, 12 years to the date, right behind me in the Astrodome here. Hurricane Rita response, where we had to evacuate, and then Hurricane Ike that hit us, and then storms in between. So we always use those experiences to really help us as we move forward. But the one thing that I would say is that no emergency is alike, and that this is a massive, massive, devastating emergency for our community. And on that national level, you know, as many of the health departments across the system know, we are oftentimes the offensive line of that football team. People don't know the work that we do until something like this happens. And so I think it's really important to know that resources for capabilities are absolutely always necessary. Do we have enough? You never have enough, but we have really what we think right now to continue to manage this acute phase.
All right, Dr. Shah, thank you very much. Good luck to you. And we'll be right back with our panel.
Thank you.
So stay with us.
CBS News Radio podcasts are now on Spotify. Listen to great shows like Face the Nation, the CBS News Weekend Roundup, CBS This Morning, and more. They're all from your Spotify app on your iOS or Android device. CBS News Radio on Spotify, the leading global music streaming service, now lets you find the right podcast for every moment. Open Spotify to listen to CBS News Radio podcasts today.
And we're back with our political panel. Ruth Marcus is the deputy editorial page editor and columnist for The Washington Post. David Sanger is the national security correspondent for The New York Times. My namesake, Margaret Talib, over here is the senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg. And Nancy Youssef covers national security for The Wall Street Journal. Overnight, David, we had some big news, North Korea carrying out a major nuclear test, as President Trump has tweeted. Was that a confirmation that it was what North Korea says it was?
It sure sounded like a confirmation that it was at least a big test. We don't know for sure that it was a hydrogen bomb. The North Koreans claimed about a year and a half ago that they had exploded a hydrogen bomb. We don't think they had then. But it certainly looks to be 4 to 6 times bigger than anything they've done before, which is to say 4 to 6 times bigger than the bombs that took out Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So this was a big explosion, and if they don't have a hydrogen weapon yet, they will soon. I think Mike Morrell had it about right when he described the paucity of options here, but I also think that the Trump team tested for the first time with this, they may not fully agree that there are no military options. You hear members of the team talk about military options that they think they have. They agree they'd be horrible. They agree there'd be a lot of blowback to it. But I'm not sure they're persuaded at this point that military is off the table.
Margaret, what are you hearing is happening at the White House today? The president tweeted. What's next?
That's right. And the president's two tweets on this subject were interesting because the first one was pretty measured. You could call it a General Kelly H.R. McMaster tweet. And the second one moved pretty quickly into how South Korea's weak and so is China. But the president's at church this morning, and then he will convene a meeting with his national security leaders. And I think at that point, they'll resume these conversations that have been ongoing. I mean, this is the idea that there could be a test like this has been known and predicted all summer, but to come so soon after the fire and fury comments suggests it's either a test of what President Trump will do next, a test of how China will react, maybe both. So they'll go right back today and huddle at the White House and discuss these options.
Yeah. Well, Nancy, we know that the Secretary of State's been making calls. He talked to his counterpart in South Korea. But when we talk about disconnect within the administration, you saw that earlier this week. You know, at the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, came and seemed to be reversing a statement that the president had made when the president tweeted, "Talking is not the answer." Then Mattis said, "We're never out of diplomatic options."
That's right.
Who's right? And which is the strategy?
Well, so far, Secretary Mattis has been right in that after those comments were made, the White House put out a statement about a readout of a call between President Trump and the president of South Korea, President Moon, in which they talked about diplomacy as an option. The reality is that Mattis has an interest in pushing diplomacy. From his perspective, he's trying to protect relationships with allies, reassure them that the U.S. is there to support them, reassure the West itself that there are other options than what he sees as catastrophic military options. Yes, they're there, but the consequences are so big, and nobody understands that more than the Secretary of Defense from the position where he sits and the military options that he's looking at a regular basis.
And yet the president tweeted this morning, as you referenced there, Margaret, South Korea, I've been telling them appeasement is not an option.
Yeah, it's very confusing because at some point a priority has to be chosen. Is it the trade relationship with South Korea? We saw this week some discussion about tearing up that five-year deal, or dealing with the North Korean threat. That is, allies all have to be on the same page. And if we're arguing with South Korea about trade, it makes it much harder to get on the same page about how to address South Korea. So there seems to be a back and forth about what the priority is in terms of the administration. And we saw that in the tweets in which he referred to appeasement with South Korea, which, by the way, became a breaking news alert within the South Korean press.
And that's a few things that are alarming here. One is that at the very moment that we should be making sure that we're on the same page with our allies, we seem to be unnecessarily and surprisingly provoking them, both on the talking about tearing up the trade deal and on the appeasement front. And then to David's sort of scary remarks, I understand why the administration would want North Korea to believe that military options are on the table, but there are options, but they are, as you said, catastrophic, and the thought of using them. So if talking is not the answer, it might not be the answer alone. Maybe talking with sanctions, maybe the containment, but military options are a disaster.
Well, we had the Treasury Secretary out this morning already saying, well, we're writing another round of sanctions. What are the options, David, you referred to?
Well, there are sanctions you could go do. But we've been trying sanctions since 1953 in various forms, soon after the Korean War ended. So if you wanted to do sanctions that would make a difference, you'd have to go after their energy supplies. And going after their energy supplies is very hard to do.
Unless and that's a China question.
That's a China and a Russia question, but primarily China. And the Chinese still have not come to the conclusion that it is worse to have a nuclear North Korea than to collapse North Korea. So they are not likely to do anything that would lead to collapse, and cutting off energy could go do that. There are cyber options. In other words, a way of trying to attack the North Koreans without it being clearly us and without causing the kind of chaos that you would from bombing from the air or doing something similar to that. The problem is we don't think they're terribly effective. We reported that there was a cyber operation against their missile program that President Obama authorized starting in 2014. Unfortunately, if it was working for a while, it's not working anymore terribly mm-hmm. effectively. And finally, there are options that would basically cut off all interaction with the country, intercept shipping, do the kind of embargo that the United States did against Japan prior to Pearl Harbor, tried against Cuba at various moments. But that risks conflict at sea.
Ruth, Congress is coming back in session.
I hear that.
we're gearing up for that. Senator McCain will be returning to Washington, but before that, he went to Italy, and he made some pretty extraordinary remarks at a forum, and I want to read these to you and share them with our viewers. And he pointed to sort of America's role in the world, saying many are questioning whether America is still remaining engaged in the world, upholding traditional alliances and standing up for the values we share. And this has much to do with some of the actions and statements of our president. And he gestured to the debate underway in the country right now about what kind of role America should play in the world. The future of the world will turn, to a large extent, on how this debate in America is resolved. What is he bringing back to Washington for President Trump?
Well, you know, Senator McCain has never been exactly shy about stating his views, but now he's sadly and gravely
this
ill.
This is not politics ending at the water edge.
I have to point out that he wrote a very full-throated op-ed for the Washington Post this week where he talked about how Congress needed to stand up to President Trump, about how he acts as if Congress is not a co-equal branch of government. So he is back and loaded for bear, and I think deeply worried, as are many members of Congress and many of his colleagues, about a retrenchment in the world of the United States and a need to sort of send signals to our allies that while they may have qualms about this president, he will not be president forever, and that the U.S. is not going to abandon its role in the world.
Margaret, that's an extraordinary message to be sharing with our allies, but Senator McCain clearly thought it was a necessary one.
Yeah, I mean, I think John McCain is in full legacy slash leave nothing on the table mode right now. And he's saying the things that the House Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader either don't feel that they should say or feel that they can't say strategically for reasons that have to do with party unity or midterm elections. But I also think that if you asked McCain, he would say that Trump started it in terms of not leaving politics at the water's edge, and that the president crossed the line in a way that previous presidents haven't. Where does this all go? Politically speaking, in terms of geopolitics, look at Angela Merkel. Look at the French leader, look at the rest of the world leaders, our Western allies increasingly open to publicly expressing some of their concerns about U.S. leadership. So I'm not sure, broad strokes, what impact it has on the world. I think domestically it has an impact, and McCain's effort seems to be to embolden Republicans in Congress to speak out more forcefully, even if it involves contradicting the administration.
Well, the crisis most immediate at home has been Harvey. You saw the president return to the state of Texas this weekend, and he said, as tough as it has been, it's been a wonderful thing to watch. Perhaps a reference to some of the signs of unity there. Sure. Ruth, how do you grade the president's response?
So I think you need to grade the president on two different metrics. One is kind of technical merit. How well has the federal government, working with state and local governments, responded to this crisis? On the tech, and that may be the most important metric. And I would give the administration so far a good grade on that. We have not, Brownie would not have gotten in trouble for a heck of a job, Brownie, if he had been, in fact, been doing a heck of a job. So on that, some worries about what's happening with these Superfund sites, some quibbles about if these proposed budget cuts had gone through, what might have happened. But technical merit, good grade. On the emotional response, let's be clear, this president is kind of empathy impaired. And so I think he wants to say the right thing, but the right thing doesn't come out of his mouth. So you see comments like the one you cited. He'll talk about the great turnout. He'll talk. He'll use the opportunity to take a jab at the media. He doesn't do feel your pain very well. That is not good for him. It's not good for the country, but I think he's trying his best on that.
Does the debt ceiling increase that needs to happen get tied to this Harvey relief?
I think in a strange way, all of the problems that are coalescing in September for Congress in a very short time frame, the debt ceiling, the government funding, have been made, ironically, perhaps a little bit easier by Harvey. So some of the usual, because we're going to need billions of dollars, the administration has asked for the first tranche of that money. And so the usual maneuvering about how we can't do this without offsets and things like that, and the threats to FEMA operations and other operations that would not just come from the debt ceiling, but from shutting down the government. I'm hopeful that Harvey, for all the suffering it's caused, I don't want to be empathy impaired myself, is going to make what needs to happen in Washington a little bit easier.
And we know the president's going to announce his decision on this deferred action that's going to impact the children of immigrants who brought their kids here illegally. That's going to be on the 5th. Does that impact, undo the goodwill that we've been talking about?
It depends both on what plan he's going to unveil and how he unveils it. And
do we have indications so far?
We do, but sort of. But everyone I talk to in the White House says that this has been a matter of intense debate where feelings have changed and shifted in terms of precisely what to do. But look, here are the parameters that we all know. There is some push for congressional Republicans to take the lead on the fix. And there is the counterbalancing threat of the lawsuit, the court challenge by a group of red state states' attorneys general. And the president trying to find that sweet spot in the middle where he fulfills a campaign promise to crack down on illegal immigration but shows empathy for dreamers. So what does that look like? Does the president say the administration is not going to enforce, not going to support, you know, defend DACA in court challenges and really wants Congress to fix it and then kind of leave it to Congress to fix it. Some version of that is what people are expecting. But as we all know with this administration, until it happens, it's very hard to know precisely what. The thinking, though, with DACA, just like you see Harvey potentially tied to debt ceiling, there's a thought that if this ends up in Congress with real action, there may be potentially room for compromise where DACA and some sort of wall effort are paired together. And that's the thing to look for next week.
Oh, it's a long, long laundry list, and we've got through about half of it right now. Thank you.
Americans have been moved by the pictures and stories of people helping others, even total strangers, in the aftermath of Harvey. A rare moment of unity in an often divided nation. We ask one of our favorite native Texans, Bob Schieffer, who covered his first hurricane in Texas back in 1967, to give us his thoughts about Harvey, a storm that hit Texas 50 years later.
Hurricane Beulah was my first one. It slammed into the Texas coast back in 1967, before I came to CBS. It left one-sixth of my home state underwater. Harvey would be even worse. But as I watched what Harvey wrought, I was struck by just how similar those pictures were to my memories of Beulah 50 years ago. Our technology is so good now, we knew exactly when Harvey would make landfall and a lot more. But it's not the technology we remember. It's realizing the awesome power of nature. This was Beulah. This is Harvey. Somehow the big ones always turn out worse than we thought. This is me, one day into Katrina.
We knew it was bad. Tonight we are beginning to understand just how bad.
In a hurricane, it's all hands on deck, whatever your job. Reporter Brandy Smith of our Houston affiliate, KHOU, was doing a live report when she saw a man trapped in a flooded truck. She flagged down a rescue boat team and led them to him.
I am terrified for him, and here he comes.
As she was reporting, her station was being evacuated because of high water. But it's always the most vulnerable who suffer the most. These kids got through Beulah. These will make it through Harvey. The pictures of traffic jams of Texans who didn't wait to be asked for help made me proud. They just loaded their boats on trailers and headed into the worst of it. Nor will I soon forget the pictures of these poor people in a retirement home. We can be thankful they were found. As it always is, we saw the worst bring out our best. After the awful scenes we saw just weeks ago in Charlottesville, in Texas, we saw white kids and black kids just being kids. In a hurricane, it doesn't matter if you are black or white or brown or purple. Maybe we do have to be taught to hate. The statistics this storm has generated are staggering. More important are the numbers we'll never really know. All those who just showed up to help. Like Mattress Mack, the furniture dealer, who opened his showroom as a shelter to hundreds. Singers who sang.
Oh, my soul.
Barbers who showed up at shelters with their clippers. People forming human chains to rescue others from the flood.
Go, 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 go.
Bakers who baked, and the pizza guy who would not be deterred. And yes, that is Spider-Man. Only Texans would know all this unfolded on and around the very battlefield where Sam Houston and his ragtag army against all odds fought for and won Texas independence from Mexico. This week, their descendants met another powerful force. It's not over yet, but my money is on Texas. For Face the Nation, this is Bob Schieffer.
That's it for us today. Thanks for watching. John Dickerson will be back next Sunday. I'm Margaret Brennan, and this has been Face the Nation. Today's guests were FEMA Director Brock Long and Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsnick. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation's also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern Time every Sunday.